Good evening. I wish we were coming to you live from the International Storytelling like we've been doing for the past 9 years, but with the advent of COVID-19, we are doing things a little bit differently this month for the Storytown radio show. We were calling in, each of us, from our safe spaces, and I'm sitting here very safely distanced from our station manager, Wayne Winkler, to record a little piece here for you folks at home. We did things a little bit differently tonight for our radio show. We gathered stories about current events that are happening right now from people who are on the front lines, working in our VA, working in grocery stores, working for the Department of Defense, and put those stories together in a script, as well as people who are staying home right now for the safety of everybody else. We've also gone back in time and collected some stories from other points of crises that our country has gone through and that our community has gone through. Because listening to those stories, knowing that people before us made it through some really difficult times, it helps give us some hope that, yes, we are having hard times now and we're going to make it through. And we're going to make it through by staying connected with each other, even if we can't be physically with each other. We're going to be connected through our hearts and our stories, and we're going to share a little bit of both with you tonight. Before we start, I do want to say a big thanks to our sponsors who are always there making things possible for us, the Tennessee Arts Commission, the Wild Women of Jonesboro, Main Street Catering and Cafe, Nancy Hope and Odie Major, as well as a special sponsor this month, the Butterfly Farm Sanctuary in Canton, North Carolina. So here are our stories for tonight in an episode that we're calling Changes.
What's changed for me? Nothing and everything. Nothing in that I'm an essential worker, so I'm still going to work 5 days a week, Saturday through Wednesday. My wife, Michelle, is also an essential worker. And everything. And that we both work at the VA, where several cases have been suspected. Luckily, so far, there have been no active cases of COVID-19 there. Well, knock on wood. But the kinds of interactions I used to have with the people I work with, you know, from the patients to the staff, is totally different now. On Saturdays and Sundays, I work at the Community Living Center in the short-term rehabilitation wing. The rest of the week I spent at the main hospital, usually in the ICU ward. One of my favorite things I used to do was talk to the veterans at the CLC. I'm a veteran myself, so it's easier for them to open up to me. But these days I can't. Social distancing and everyone wearing masks now. Remember how bad it was at the nursing home in Seattle when this all began? In response to that incident, we have moved as many patients as possible out of the CLC and sent them home. Well, I worry about them almost as much as the patients who are still here. Because with some of them, it felt like I was the only one they got to talk to all week long, and now I can't, and it's frustrating. We don't allow any visitors at the CLC or in the ICU now during this crisis, and only staff and patients are there these days. I see posts all day from people who are suddenly isolated, and I think, wow, these men and women I see at the CLC, they spend most of their time in this kind of isolation. Now even those few who used to be visitors can't anymore. And in the ICU, when people are probably the most hurt or injured, they're all alone. I hope that when this is over, people remember this feeling of isolation. Maybe do something about it. Sit with an older member of your family or maybe your chosen family. Check in on a relative or a neighbor. Visit with a veteran. And just be there to talk, even if it is just once a week. Think of what a difference it would make, not just in their lives, but maybe in your own.
I am a retired registered nurse, and now that I'm in my 70s, because of COVID-19, I'm part of a high-risk group, even though my health is very good. I felt a strong pull to serve, and though I can't be walking the halls with the nurses today, I found a way to help them. I'm a seamstress, so it made sense that I would make masks. Into my stash I dove. All you seamstresses know just what I mean by stash. Soon my stash dwindled, and I put out a call to friends for material. They came from all corners. Some even brought their husband's old shirts. Yes, 100% cotton. Now, if you thought TP was the most valuable thing during crisis, you haven't run out of elastic. Yes, elastic. Well, in the post office this week, mailing out masks, I caught up with a friend mailing out, yes, masks. I asked her, not about TP, but about elastic. She had just received 100 yards of this precious item. She offered me some, and I followed her home to pick it up to get me going again. I discovered it wasn't just the nurses and doctors who need them right now. I started getting calls to help from our essential workers throughout the town who were still providing services to us, putting our own lives in danger in order to carry out important roles. It feels good to know I'm doing what I can do to help my friends in the community stay safe by supplying them with masks. So far, I've given out over 100 masks. Remember, if you can't do what you want, do what you can. Making masks, it's what I can do.
I have seen how this disease has started to change the perceptions of people just a little bit. A few years ago, I would help gather food donations for an organization I worked for. At that time, it was called Donations and Commodities. We would especially get staples of rice, dried beans, peanut butter, and crackers, sometimes off-brand canned vegetables, fruit, and juice. I rarely saw anything fresh, though, in the box. One day, a man came to me and said, "I am so thankful for this food, but I truly don't know what to do with these items month after month. I am taking care of my wife who has Alzheimer's. I wish I knew recipes and ways to use this food. I wish that in the box I could see a choice of meal plans and how to put these things together." I thought maybe he means a way to prep the use of a meal, maybe a set of recipes. I thought this made a lot of sense. I presented that to my colleagues, and they laughed and said, "Go ahead if you want. Most of them don't care. We don't have the money or the resources to run off paper and recipes anyway. At least they get some help." I was frustrated by their response. Later that afternoon, they ordered takeout from an area restaurant. The bill was $65. I thought, just with that one order, we could have put fresh, healthy, made food in that box and bought some paper to run off recipes for fixings like rice and beans or casseroles or something. Life for a lot of us is this way. We just don't realize our means. Now the COVID-19 is bringing everyone to a standpoint. A week trip to the grocery store has us buying off-brand foods and products and long-lasting staples like rice and dried beans and canned goods, and we don't always get what we're looking for, and a lot of us don't know how to prepare these things. Some people will be with one paycheck or no paycheck in their families when they are used to having two or more paychecks. Will we remember this during this time, the lowest of the lowest and the least of the least? Is this what it takes to bring us to our knees? What can we teach others through this? More importantly, what can we each learn? During this time of isolation, will we consider more deeply our parents and grandparents who lived in isolation during their growing up years, or in their years in the nursing homes or at private residence? This is one of my many awakening moments. My parents said to me a time or two that my smile was fading. The song in my heart was quieting. I care so much for people. I was once told by my managers that people can eat you alive and you have to toughen your heart. They tried to make me believe that. I could never grasp that idea, though, and in their company, I struggled. But compassion is out there through all of this. It has to be. We see it emerging now. When this is over, I hope we continue to hold on to this newly awakened sense of compassion for all the rice and beans and peanut butter in the world to sustain us. Love is also a commodity, and luckily, it doesn't need instructions or recipe cards. It's ready for use right out of the box, healthy and nourishing and always available.
My name is Catherine Yael, and I live in the woods. I said goodbye to a 45-year career in human services 3 weeks ago. Bit of an identity crisis for a mental health therapist, but now I'm freed up to pursue a dual avocation of writer, storyteller, and horticulturalist. I spent 25 years as a nursery stock and Christmas tree grower, but that was 20 years ago. and I've been trying to get back there ever since. Yesterday, sitting on the warm earth, sifting rich dirt through my hands as I prepared to install more blueberry bushes in newly broken ground, I was reminded of the healing properties of the earth eternal, the sun that rises and sets and brings forth life from the winter's bare ground, the moon that gives light by night, the seasons that march forward in their predictability. These cycles are eternal and immutable and outlast all temporal disruption. What could I do but praise God?
Change comes on quickly. As a historian, I know this. Lives are changed in an instant by fires, floods, assassinations, war, and pandemics. I never expected to be living through one of those globe-changing moments, though. Everything I knew, everything I thought was certain and safe, like getting out of bed and going to the local supermarket, changed in a matter of days. I wonder if this is how it felt to live in Jonesboro in 1873 during the cholera epidemic. History never repeats itself completely, but there are patterns that emerge through time. The July 10th, 1873 edition of the Herald and Tribune was a hodgepodge of information about cholera and the current epidemic as it moved through the South. It was reminiscent of Facebook in early March of this year as the COVID-19 pandemic really began to make its presence known in the United States. In that 1873 edition of the paper, the editor's note was dedicated to cholera in Tennessee. The disease had yet to hit Jonesboro.
This terrible scourge has been prevailing for several weeks in different parts of the state and seems to have abated at no point except Nashville. For the last few days, the number of deaths at the Capitol have decreased very much, but at other points it seems to be on the increase. At Chattanooga, where it first made its appearance only a few days since, the mortality is very great. At Greenville, the number of deaths have perhaps been even greater, according to the population, than at any other place. The loss of life has indeed been great. Many who could boast of good health one day were cold in death the next. The town, we understand, is almost deserted, only a few remaining to nurse their families who are sick. Jonesboro and Johnson City have been liberal, as well as citizens along the railroad line, in sending provisions and other necessities to do everything possible for the comfort of the afflicted. While this has been done for those who remain in the doomed city, we should not forget others who have fled with their families and who have no means to support themselves. Kindness, friendship, and favors bestowed upon them now, while they are sad and desponding, will no doubt be highly appreciated. And we are sure it will have a tendency to cheer and console them in their distress. We hope the citizens of this place and of the county will remember them in their affliction and extend to them all the favors possible in furnishing houses and provisions until they can safely return home. In the next edition on July 17, 1873, there was general misinformation about what caused and cured cholera. Germ theory wouldn't be developed until a few years after this epidemic. We again reiterate our warning to the people to abstain as much as possible from eating unripe vegetables and from indulging in fruits to any extent. Nearly every case has been so far traced to some local cause, either in the neighborhood or in the diet of the individual afflicted. While persons who live in a healthy locality and use proper discretion in regard to diet and habits are comparatively free from the disorder. There was also the report of a cholera-related death in town. Messrs. Editors, permit me through the columns of your paper to thus make my grateful acknowledgments to the good people of Jonesboro, who so promptly and unceasingly rendered kind and important services to myself and family during the last illness of my dear wife. I shall ever feel grateful for their kind attention, so liberally bestowed and shall ever be ready and willing to render personal or other attention whenever and wherever I may be called upon to do so. Signed, A.C. Collins, on behalf of himself and family.
Overall, though, the message for Jonesboro was positive. We have the pleasure of reporting the health of Jonesboro good. There is not a case of cholera in town or within 10 miles of the place that we have heard of. Our physicians report but 3 cases of cholera in town this season, 2 of which were citizens of Greenville and have recovered, and Mrs. A.C. Collins, who died last Tuesday morning. If our citizens continue to use the same precaution in the future that they have for the last month or two, we need have no fear of the disease spreading here. But that was the calm before the storm, the last bit of disbelief before reality set in. After the July 17th edition, the Herald and Tribune did not publish again until August 14, 1873. What happened during that time? Well, the cholera epidemic hit Jonesboro head on. Most people left, leaving only 100 people in town. Many of those who stayed behind were already sick. The doctors stayed to care for them, as did a few family members. The businesses were closed. I imagine it was a very quiet 3 weeks. When I walk down Main Street today and see the shops closed and the lack of foot traffic, I wonder if that was what it felt like that summer in 1873. Out of 100 people who stayed behind, an estimated 35 people perished from cholera. The August 14th edition reported, in resuming the publication of the Herald and Tribune, which, like all other business enterprises in Jonesboro, has been suspended for the past few weeks on account of the terrible visitation of cholera which we have experienced, we have a melancholy duty to perform in recording the names of the victims of that fell destroyer, those who have been fortunate in escaping with their lives from the malignant scourge that has brought death and desolation into so many households, will in the future miss many familiar faces from the streets of Jonesboro. The paper was quick to identify the true heroes of the epidemic, the doctors and the caretakers who stayed behind to tend to the sick. There are times that try men's souls, and there are also circumstances that develop men. Many previously obscure individuals who, under ordinary circumstances, avoid notice, in times of great public emergencies, come forth and exhibit at once all the qualities that distinguish the hero from the common man. The late fearful scourge of cholera in Jonesboro, while it has in many cases developed the weakness and natural timidity of some individuals, has caused others to exhibit, in a marked degree, that true heroism which knows and appreciates the danger before them, but prompts them to face it from a sense of duty. Again today, we applaud our healthcare workers as they fight COVID-19 on the front line. We applaud our grocery store clerks, custodial workers, and all essential employees for their role in keeping essential businesses open and running so that the rest of us can stay home and do our part to combat this virus. When will life go back to normal as we used to know it? And that's hard to say. And it was hard to say in 1873, too. The August 21st edition of the Herald and Tribune reported, whether the dread disease will now leave East Tennessee or whether it will swoop down upon some of our neighboring towns carrying death and destruction in its path, we cannot conjecture. Its movements are mysterious and uncertain. We cannot anticipate them. We can only wait and prepare. Chances are, life will never go back to the way it was before the coronavirus pandemic. Not 100%, but that is to be expected. This can also be a good thing. The epidemics of the late 1800s greatly changed the way we approach life. They discouraged spitting on streets. They encouraged a movement that worked to enclose sewers and bring better living conditions to workers crammed into tenement houses. They led to great scientific breakthroughs. I'm interested to see what we will have learned on the other side of this pandemic. How will COVID-19 impact life 20, 50, and 100 years from now? More than anything, as a historian, I know that life goes on one way or another. The August 21st edition of the paper also reported, the businessmen of Jonesboro, who have been absent sometime or again at their post. Some of the citizens of the county seem to have fears of visiting the town yet, but we are pleased to notice that every day we can notice an improvement in trade, and hope it will be but a few days so we can report a brisk business. So we'll wait, and we'll follow the advice of the medical experts, and this current scourge will pass one way or another. In the meantime, keep a record of your experiences during this uncertain time. I promise you, a future historian will thank you for it.
You know, sometimes it's really great to look back at those historical stories because they give us a way to see the world. They let us see that things happen in cycles and that there's always some place or somewhere where we can find hope. Here's Linda Poland with one of those stories.
I want to tell y'all about the place I grew up in. We had a big house, and it was made up like an apartment. We lived on one side, and my grandparents lived in a part of the other. And we had a cafe built onto our home. There were always people coming in and out, especially on a Friday or Saturday night. I remember peeking through the crack in the door to the cafe, and there would be so many people having a good time, eating, dancing, some of them drinking the little happy drink that made them feel good. I didn't understand as a child just how important that cafe was to the grown-ups. You see, people were scared. We were at war, and everything about our normal lives had changed. Almost all the men my dad's age were off in the war. People needed a chance to talk, to dance, and to have fun, and forget about their troubles for a little while. I never would have guessed that half a century later, that same cafe would become a soup kitchen. Feeding people who are in need of a hot meal and a place to have a conversation, have fun, and forget about their troubles for a while. The troubles in the world have a way of circling around, but our community has its way of overcoming these troubles. Times are hard, but if we never forget how to laugh, and we never forget how to dance, and we never forget how to take care of each other, then I know this, trouble won't last always.
For me, the hardest part of the pandemic has been isolation from my sweet mama, who lives in Four Oaks Nursing Home. All visitation there stopped March 10th, one day before the World Health Organization officially designated COVID-19 a pandemic. A week later, her hospice nurses were no longer allowed inside. I understand why, but it doesn't make it any easier. She is wheelchair-bound with advanced COPD, a degenerative lung disease, and is on oxygen 24 hours a day. Sweet Mama has struggled with dementia for over a decade, and since the pandemic, her dementia has progressed. The lack of human contact has drastically increased her anxiety, fear, and inability to communicate. The first few days, Sweet Mama was pleasantly confused. Instead of spending time with her every day, I came to the window to see her. We couldn't hear each other through the glass, and she no longer wanted to talk on the phone because it upset her. It was heartbreaking to see her waving me in, panic and distress on her face. About the only thing I could do was fill the bird feeder, water the flowers, and hope for a better day tomorrow. We used to go time traveling together every day. When I walked in her room, I never knew where I'd be. All I know is that we were somewhere she felt more at home in and more secure in. Now I'm not able to be her companion for the journey, so she has a harder time making her way back to the present. The employees are kind to her. The office staff now makes regular rounds. And one day, Catherine was checking in on Sweet Mama and asked if she wanted to surprise me with a phone call. When I answered the phone, Sweet Mama was very adamant that I should drive over, sneak in the front door, and when I got to her room, she would grab me and nail the door shut. In her mind, whatever it took so we could be together. You can't replace physical touch, but it was important to focus on the little things to lift her spirits. I planted a pinwheel flower garden. Each one was a different color, and she enjoys watching them dance and spin from her wheelchair or bed. But the best part was that several weeks later, pinwheel flowers started popping up by other resident windows. I danced a jig on St. Patty's Day. I made posters for the window. One was a lovely spring green with the Irish blessing, "Until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand." Another was her favorite shade of yellow that reminded her, "Everything will be okay soon, and we'll be able to come inside and be with you." But each day, sweet mama is less active, less engaged, and more impaired. But there is grace during painful times. Last week, as I watched through the window, a new nurse assistant was helping sweet mama and got her talking and smiling. Slowly, sweet mama took Tasha's hand and tenderly brought it to her face, gently stroking her hand. Tears trickled down Tasha's face, but she didn't remove her hand. It was a magical moment of connection that I will never forget. I am so grateful that she gave sweet mama a loving embrace that I can't give her through the window.
Since I've been home, I've been able to work on my garden, but I missed having my guests. I had a little Airbnb here in Jonesboro, but had to stop. Luckily, this was my retirement job, and I don't need that income. Oh, but I do miss my guests. B&Bs, I guess you could say, have a long tradition here since Jonesboro's beginning. When I was coming up, many people around here had a small room at the front of their house, which was used for visitors, like my own grandmother had. It was usually furnished with a bed, a small table with something to eat, wash basin, and a towel. Travel was hard through these parts. If you had some money, you'd go by stagecoach along the road that runs by my home. But in the early days, folks went on horseback or even by foot. If it fell dark, they'd sleep under the cover of trees. But if they made it to a small town like this, they could use the visitor's room, like my little Airbnb. It was mighty appreciated, since the Chester Inn was, about the only hotel in the whole region. It was usually furnished, like mine is now, with a bed, a table with snacks. I added a few modern additions like an internet password and little bars of soap. Back then, there wouldn't be any registration or anything formal like that. They'd just leave the doors to the visitor's room open. A quilt on a rack in the window was a sign that you were welcome. But if the quilt was removed, it meant someone was already there. Most travelers knew these places. They usually arrived after dark and left before dawn. It was customary to leave a token of appreciation. Well, it might be a fruit, a pin note, a trinket, something to show gratitude. I never met most of the people who stayed with my grandmother, but we always knew a little bit something about them by the things they left behind. One visitor who stayed at my grandmother's house, every 2 or 3 months, always left a cutting of a plant. It would be wrapped in soil in a moist rag. We had a large empty space beside our house that we called the lane. Grandma planted the cuttings there. The lane filled up with the most colorful flowers and shrubs. As years went by, that lane became the garden. And Grandma, she called her garden gratitude. I will be grateful when this pandemic is over and I can open my doors back up to my visitors. Luckily, I get to meet and talk with my new guests, and my heart is filled with gratitude for the friendships that have blossomed like flowers, just like those in my grandmother's garden. The gratitude for friendship is ever present.
I had to close my business. I understand why I had to. I didn't even question the reason for it. I want to keep everyone safe, especially my employees who are family to me. It's been a month now. The rent is due, but we've had no income. I paid my staff for the month in advance with what I had. Like I said, they're family. But now, it looks like I'll be going into default, and I don't know if I'll be able to open my doors again. I had to send a letter to my staff telling them they should apply for unemployment because I can't pay them again this month, and I don't know when we'll be able to be open. Believe me, I would if I could, in good conscience. But if I knew that I was responsible for spreading illness to just one person, I'd never be able to live with myself. But I don't know how I'll be able to live myself in the next month or two. I didn't pay myself last month, trying to take care of my staff. For a while, I thought this would blow over quickly. That's what I was led to believe, but it isn't so. That's the problem with my business. We're not essential. But this business was essential to me, to us. It was my bread and butter, and now I have neither. For now, I am safe at home, isolated. I can be grateful for that. For a little while, until I can't pay the mortgage. I never thought, at 53 years old, I would be looking at filing for bankruptcy and facing the real possibility of becoming homeless. And we were doing so well. So well. When change comes, it comes fast.
When I was a child in Southern California, my family used to drive down to Mexico once every few months for a day of shopping and fun. One Easter weekend, I had just turned 3 and my brother was 1.5 years old. We brought back 2 enormous plaster piggy banks. They looked like real pigs and were almost as large as we kids were when we sat down beside them on the living room floor. Mine was pink with brown spots, and my brother's was white with black spots. They each had a big slot on the back of their necks where coins could be dropped in. There was no plug on the bottom, though. They were old-fashioned piggy banks that would have to be broken with a hammer someday when they were finally full. We kids were pretty little and could not imagine that day coming, nor any amount of money saved up that would make me want to break my precious and beautiful pig. Children live in the now, and every evening when Daddy came home from work, he'd empty his pockets of the change that had accumulated. I learned how to count by ones, fives, tens, and 25s. As the pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters were divided into 2 equal piles and then dropped, clink, 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 down into the pigs. This went on for over 1 year, and even though we kids grew a lot bigger than the pigs became so heavy we could not move them. They sat, one on each side of the fireplace hearth, and were almost members of the family. One Thursday evening in early October 1962, the grown-up conversation at the dinner table was more tense and obscure than usual. Walter Cronkite on the evening news looked very worried, but I was 4.5 and had no idea where Cuba was or why all the grown-ups were upset about it. Well, after dinner, my dad went out to the garage and got his big hammer, and Mama got out a picnic blanket and spread it on the living room floor. Daddy placed the 2 plaster pigs in the center of the blanket and announced that it was time to break them open. I was devastated. I loved my pig, and I liked the evening ritual of dropping in the carefully counted coins. But Daddy and Mama explained that this was an emergency, and there was no help for it but to break the pigs and get the saved-up money out. So the pigs were smashed, and the pile of coins that resulted was impressive. It actually took the whole family that evening, and Mama and me most of the next morning, to count and roll up all the coins. By the time Daddy came home from work that evening, there was over $100 in rolled coins waiting on the kitchen table. That was a lot of money in those days. Next to the box with the coins was a shopping bag filled with all the filled books of saving stamps from the grocery stores. Green stamps came with the register receipt at every trip to the store,
and when the books were full of pasted-in stamps, they were redeemable just like money at certain stores. The next day was Saturday, and after breakfast, we piled into Gertie, our old black Studebaker sedan, and took the green stamp books and the box of rolled coins to the Montgomery Ward store. There, with these forms of ready cash, available even on a weekend when banks were closed, we purchased a whole lot of camping equipment, including 4 sleeping bags, mine was red, a Coleman stove with extra canisters of its fuel, a big tent folded up in a box, and 3 big jerry cans, 1 green and 2 red. On the way home, we stopped at a gas station, and after the attendant filled Gertie's gas tank, Daddy had him fill the 2 red jerry cans as well and put them in the trunk. Daddy used the white hose marked H2O to fill the green can with water and put it in the trunk too. What I didn't understand was that tensions between the U.S. and USSR had reached a fever pitch in an incident that came to be known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. We happened to live in one of the areas that was sure to be an initial target because of the number of nearby naval and military bases. The governor was considering an evacuation order for all of Orange County, and that consideration was enough for Daddy to decide he needed to keep his family safe. So when he arrived home, with all the camping equipment still in the car, Mother took us kids inside and told us each to choose our 3 favorite books and 2 toys to take with us on an adventure. She quickly began to throw clothes and toothbrushes into a suitcase. By the early afternoon, we were all back in Gertie, headed north up Highway 1. We had family in Oregon and Washington, and even though I had never met them, Mama assured us it would be a fun adventure. The highway was full of cars on our side, all loaded with families, and all headed in the same direction. The other side of the road was nearly empty. No one was driving south. We drove all afternoon, with our parents listening to news instead of music on the radio. And that evening, we were setting up our camp in a state park, surrounded by other families doing the same, when suddenly the radio news said something that made the grown-ups all relax and start laughing about a wasted trip. A negotiated settlement had been reached, so we all ate hot dogs cooked over our spanking new Coleman stoves, and then some families went ahead and stayed the night. But my parents took our tent down, folded it back into its box, packed everything back in the car. We drove through the night and returned onto our own street just as the sun was coming up. So that was my almost 5-year-old experience of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We were safe after all, and we never made it to Oregon. But it was the end of the giant plaster pigs, and one wonderful thing did come out of that. Mama asked Daddy a few days later if the camping equipment could all be returned, and she sighed about having wasted her carefully saved books of green stamps. Daddy said, though, that since a lot of the money had come from the kids' piggy banks, it was only right to use the camping equipment for some fun for Debbie and Carl. So, from that time forward, almost every Friday night when Daddy came home from work, he would change out of his white work shirt and tie and creased pants into jeans and a cowboy shirt. We kids would be all packed and ready, and Mama would have the cooler full of food, and off we went to camp for the weekend in the Angeles National Forest or the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, Carlsbad Caverns, Painted Desert National Monument. After a while, old Gertie got traded in for a different car, and Daddy also bought a pickup truck with a camper that sat on its back, and then the camping trips got longer and more wild. Carl and I would ride in the camper on the mattress bed perched out over top of the truck's cab with a walkie-talkie to keep in touch with our parents down below. When no one in the family had seen a telephone pole for at least half an hour, we would stop and set up our camp in the desert or forest wilderness for the weekend or the week. There were lots of other stories that came out of those adventures, and camping became the best and most formative part of my childhood. But it all started because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, with the smashing of the giant plaster pigs and a long ride in old Gertie, the black Studebaker.
We've got more stories about folks that are working on the front lines of COVID-19, as well as some stories from the past that give us a little bit of direction. Up next is Gary McConnell.
Things are getting hard to find. It reminds me almost of the war years when so many goods were rationed. I remember so well how creative my mother was in making things work with what she could find. I'm glad I learned that skill from her. With cleaning items, paper towels, and too difficult to find items, I had to come up with an idea for everyone to be able to wash their hands and not reuse the same towel. At the time, paper towels were in short supply. I purchased 2 packages each of washcloths and dish towels. At Sam's Club, a 24-pack dish towel cost $12 plus change, and a 24-pack washcloth cost $13 plus change. Dish towels went into the kitchen for hand drying. Washcloths went into the bathroom. I lined a clothes hamper with a sheet to discard the used towels into. When time to launder them, I scooped them up in the sheet and put the whole thing into the washing machine. Ta-da! It worked like a charm.
School closed. At first, it was kind of fun, but after a week, I started to miss my friends and my teacher. My mom is teaching me now. She's okay, but she doesn't get math. I think the hardest thing is that when we left school that day, we didn't know we wouldn't be back for a whole year. I didn't get to say bye to my friends.
Thanks, Perry. I know it's been hard on you kids that haven't been able to go back to school yet. Well, coming up, we've got a lot of stories from our essential workers. Let's hear what they have to say.
I am an essential worker. This might be the first time anyone has ever recognized me and my coworkers as such, but here we are in this new reality. By working at Walmart, I'm essential because we provide the community a place to buy food and necessities. I am thankful to be able to go to work every day. This awful disease really scares me, but I don't let it consume me. My biggest fear is infecting my loved ones if I was to ever contract it. That is why I only see my mama from about 10 feet away. I do the same with my father-in-law. I think one of the things that has bothered me the most is I miss our weekly time going out to eat, shopping, and spending time together, and just being able to give hugs. I started making little PSA posts about how to best shop to keep yourself and others safe, and to maybe add a little humor to all of my friends' days.
The shipyard is part of DOD, which is critical for national security. While I take pride in what I do, I work with 25,000 other employees. If you've read the statistics about this virus, you know the chances of me catching it are fairly high with day-to-day interaction with everyone. From the turnstiles at the beginning of the shift that thousands of people have touched, to the handrails on the stairs leading up to the carrier, to the equipment we all share. Like I said, I take pride in what I do, repairing nuclear carriers for our Navy. Yeah, I may not be on the front lines of actual warfare, but a biological warfare like this feels just as terrifying. It feels like we're at war with a tiny army of viruses, a silent terrorist, ready to take me and my family hostage at any moment. I think that's what scares me the most, that I can't keep an eye out for this terrorist, because it walks among us, inhabiting my friends and coworkers, silent for up to 2 weeks before we notice. And by the time the symptoms appear, we're already too late to do anything to stop it.
I'm essential. I'm also in a high-risk category as someone with a diminished immune system after surviving breast cancer 2 years ago, and having gone through chemotherapy. I work in an office that normally houses approximately 300 valid corporate employees. Currently, about half are working from home remotely. My husband has a Mac and is one of those able to do so. Our kids, 19 and 21, work in food service and a grocery store, so they are both out in the public 4 to 5 days a week, right in my household. It's like the situation of the country that's playing out today. One goes to work, immediately showers afterwards, and tosses those clothes into the laundry so as not to contaminate anyone else in the family. The other is going about as if business as usual, not practicing social distancing. We talk with her about compromised immune systems within our household and the need for self-quarantine, but something isn't clicking. I don't know if it is from the early messaging that this wasn't anything too serious or a generational thing. Like those spring break college students in Florida, or a combination, or what? But I do know this. Nobody is safe at home if someone is an essential worker and not practicing social distancing and brings all the germs they met that day home to the family. It puts us all in a difficult situation. Tensions are high and nerves are fraying, but we still try and have family dinners and play board games, at least three of us anyway. We're getting through, but when one out of four is not with the program, it stresses the rest of the household. And I feel like this is what's happening all over the country. And that's why we have 500,000 cases in the U.S. now. I just pray we won't become one of those statistics.
I work at a grocery store. Never in my life while working there has anyone called out to me from a safe distance, of course, and said, "Thank you for what you're doing." It happened to me 5 times last week. I'm still not used to it. First time it happened, I was glad I was wearing a mask because, honest to goodness, I started to cry. Grown man. I don't know where it came from. Maybe this sudden sense of feeling appreciated. I'm just doing my job. I never thought it was important before. You never really thought it was either, I bet. I used to think, hey, well, I work at a grocery store, but at least I'm putting food on my table. But now I see it's more than that. I'm helping you put food on your table, too. In our little daily transactions, we're allowing life to happen. In this whole web of life, we're all starting to realize that each one of us is essential. I don't know how this will play out in the future once this is all over. But despite all the really, really hard stuff happening right now, and all the fear, and all the illness, there's this strange sort of counterbalance happening.
Then after the COVID-19 pandemic started, I saw a post on Facebook from my sister that said they're out of toilet paper. Completely out. And there's none at the store. She was panicked because she's taking care of her grandchildren so her daughter can work, 2 little kids who just started school. She didn't know what she was going to do. And some guy posted on her page, "Don't have a cow, man." What was that supposed to mean? Let's not even talk about it if it was helpful, because obviously it wasn't. We all know it's just something people say when they think someone's overreacting. Don't have a cow. As I say it, it means one thing, but when you see the words in print, they take on a whole different meaning. As if, literally, my sister's reaction was bad. As if she's birthing something really big, man. Like a cow, man. Like dealing with wiping little kids' butts without having any toilet paper ain't that bad. Not like she's giving birth to a cow. Seriously? Well, it did make me think. I can't speak for cows, but giving birth is more challenging than figuring out substitutes for toilet paper. Although, I'm not so sure that this guy had any expert qualifications for either. But my sister's had 2 children, and she knows all about the challenges of dealing with childbirth. It changes your life. Kind of like this crisis we're all dealing with right now. In fact, I would go as far as to say that most women who've birthed children have expert qualifications for dealing with the pandemic simply because they've got experience in dealing with major life changes. Think about it. When you're going to have a baby, you've got no idea what's in store for you. You think it's going to be fun and exciting. And at the end of 9 months, you're going to get this cute little bundle of baby, especially when it's the first one. That was me. I thought the worst would be over when my pregnancy ended and my firstborn was safely home. I was mistaken. When baby comes home from the hospital, everything in life changes. First, the schedule. My life now revolved around baby's stomach. It was grueling, too, and unpredictable. waking up several times at night to feed him, leaving a half-full grocery cart in the aisle and running out to the car to feed him. I learned I had to get the ice cream last because it would melt in the cart by the time I got back into the store. But that's how I dealt with that change. I improvised. I've been reading about people complaining about how their routines have changed during self-isolation, and I think, yeah, it's tough. But you don't know how bad it can be. You don't have to get up every 4 hours all night long to do your work. For months. Pity the new mother. Speaking of self-isolation, it's obvious that every new mother has a lot of experience with self-isolation. Baby has no immunity to anything. And I happen to be genetically endowed with extra amounts of the protectogen hormone that makes women avoid social interaction even when they have kids. Everyone thinks a new mom wants to stay at home because she hasn't got her figure back. But the truth is, she's naturally self-isolating to keep baby from getting sick. That's something else we have in common with new mothers. We're isolating now to keep our mothers and fathers and grandparents safe, just like they did for us. It's exactly the same. But isolating isn't the only change. There are the changes in eating habits. Another parallel. Due to breastfeeding, I changed my habits a lot. Not out of a greater concern for my own health, but babies. Can't eat this, and I should eat that. I want a hamburger, but I can't have it. It would be bad for babies. Right now, a lot of people want a hamburger or steak at their favorite sit-down restaurant, but for the sake of everyone's health, we're eating at home. Dealing with COVID-19's practical solutions are clear and easy enough, like most of those childbirth books. Do this, don't do that. Practice social distancing, wipe down doorknobs and counters, wash your hands. Simple on the surface, but the truth of the matter is that childbirth, like this coronavirus pandemic, involves fear. Fear of the unknown. Fear of things that could lead to suffering or even death. If I wasn't careful, baby could get sick or die. What a heartbreak that would be. So I was willing to take on change to protect what I love. Fear is a necessary emotion. We need to be able to react if we're in danger, and fear stimulates appropriate responses. But fear can get out of hand. How much is enough? And how much is too much? We can't raise baby in a bubble. We also can't expose baby too early to an unnecessarily dangerous situation. I didn't get a handbook with my baby. None of us did. Just like none of us got a handbook to deal with this situation, which seems to be growing and maturing on a daily basis. That said, I think we'd be wise to meet this change just as if we were new parents, suddenly facing an unpredictable world. Move through actions of love more than fear. We have babies because we have hope. We deal with incredible amounts of change because we hope that the changes will turn out for the better, even while we fear the worst. That's what we have to do now. Hope that we can save lives because we're taking measures to slow the spread of the virus. Hope that we've learned how to manage pandemics effectively so our children won't have to suffer with worse diseases in the future. It takes courage to raise children, especially when you run out of toilet paper. It takes courage to create new habits during a pandemic. But it can be done if we're not afraid of change. It may be that we'll get back to the old normal, and maybe we shouldn't expect to. Just like after having a child, the changes we're making now will shift us into a new paradigm, and we'll adjust. We'll adjust to living differently after this point. For one thing, we've all realized how essential every person we interact with is. Each one, a special, beloved being. Each one was the promise and hope of her parents and his parents. If nothing else changes, then that recognition of each other as an important, essential being, then we have more promise than fear to look forward to.
Thank you, Annie. And thanks to everyone who shared their stories to make this episode possible tonight. We'd especially like to thank all of those people that are working the front lines, helping us get through this pandemic. We'd like to thank you who are staying at home doing your part to keep everybody safe. Changes are happening, but changes have always happened. And we will find our way through these changes by staying connected to each other, by listening deeply to each other, by looking at what we've learned from the past, and by looking at hope in the future. We'd like to again thank our sponsors for this episode, the Tennessee Arts Commission, the Wild Women of Jonesboro, Main Street Cafe and Catering, Nancy Hope and Odie Major, and the Butterfly Farm Sanctuary. Be sure to tune into our podcast channel that's available on most platforms, that's Storytown Podcast. From all of us at Storytown Radio Show, be well and stay healthy.